evening and welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. I'm Darren Helwedge. Tonight, part two of our conversation with Reverend C.W. Dawson of Dawson Journeys Ministries and the African American Clergy Coalition of Mid-Missouri. We'll talk about civil rights and the role of the Black Church historically and in today's world, the role of civil rights leaders in the church and outside of it, and how younger people are responding to the traditional leadership of the civil rights movement. As we recognize Black History Month, it's an interesting discussion about both history and the present-day struggle for equality with Dr. C.W. Dawson this evening, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. C.W. Dawson is our guest. The Reverend Dr. Dawson is the president and founder of Dawson Journeys Ministries and is an adjunct professor at Columbia College. He founded the African American Clergy Coalition of Mid-Missouri. As we were talking about Dr. King, and as we get into that, and you started getting into this just a little bit ago, the role of the church in civil rights going back as far as we can.
Yeah.
As you said, the very beginning, 1617, abolition, a lot of the leadership there, not all, but a lot of it came from within the church. Talk about that a little bit and how important that's been just throughout history.
Well, you know, when I was in school, in graduate school, people talked to me about the fact that Dr. King's education honed him to be a great instrument for the civil rights movement because he had read Brightman, because he had read his Rauschenbach, Bush, because he had read Anglo folk who were both liberal and supportive of social justice, that's what kind of honed him and made him able to speak about the issues the way he did. I disagree with that. I think that those individuals were helpful and instrumental, mm-hmm. but Martin found out that he was somebody by sitting as a little kid in the Black church. Right, he had a Black pastor to tell him, you are made in the image and likeness of God. You are somebody. So even though that outside of the Black community in Atlanta, you're going to run into all kinds of racism and segregation, they're lying. You're still somebody. Mm-hmm. That people like Mordecai Johnson, who was president where he went to school, his vocabulary was just out of this world. Martin learned to speak like Mordecai Johnson. His vision of a beloved community came from Howard Thurman, who mm-hmm. came before him. So it's the context of both being in the Black church and educated in the liberal academic institution that I think worked together for him. My friend up at Michigan State, John McClendon, says to me, yeah, but Dawson, Martin never references anything he said or wrote to any African-American person. And I said, but you got to remember the context and the time. If you wanted to have credibility with white academia, you had to credit everything you did with white Western European folk.
That was what absolutely educated people talked.
That's exactly right. If he had written about Mordecai Johnson or Howard Thurman or any of those folks and what they said, they would have poo-pooed it away. Mm-hmm. So he's a victim and also a victor of his time. He's both. And I think that his nurture in the Black church was absolutely instrumental.
One of the more fascinating aspects of Dr. King's life is how beliefs evolved over time. It is so easy, and to put it in the context of what we're talking about, it's very easy as a Christian. We get taught certain things when we're in Sunday school when we're 8 years old, and we're taught this is the truth, not a truth, the truth, amen.
Right.
And it's hard as you get older to continue to accept that and continue to hold to your faith, but also have your feelings evolve about some of these things
right.
and start thinking, okay, I'm down with this, I agree with this, but this I'm not too sure about, and this is complete BS. Talk about the way King's views evolved, even in the time he was in the public spotlight, even in the time he was the quote-unquote leader of the movement. We saw his views change in a lot of ways, and that's hard to do.
Yeah, it really is hard to do. We have to remember Martin was bright. He was really bright. When the movement first started, A couple of things I think were instrumental. One is that he went to the president of the National Baptist Convention and said, listen, I believe we need to become more involved in the liberation of people, in the civil rights movement. Jackson kicked him out of the office. Told him he didn't want to talk to him anymore. And that was the birthing, by the way, of the Progressive Baptist Convention, because it saw itself as being more active. I always want to put this little caveat in when we talk about Black History Month and the Civil Rights Movement. We talk now as if everybody who is jumping and shouting and saying amen now mm-hmm. was supportive then. The fact of the matter is there were a whole lot of Black and white folk who were not supportive of what King was doing. I can remember Black conversations with people between my dad and people about, you know, that King is just making more trouble, and if you keep lining up with him, you're going to be in trouble. That there were a lot of folk who wanted another way and weren't supportive of King.
And that's forgotten to a large degree now. I love some of the stuff that Dr. West, Cornel West, has said about this. They're almost turning Martin Luther King into Santa Claus, this character that it was just loving toward everybody and nobody disagreed with and everybody liked didn't have any radical views and didn't have anything that somebody might disagree with. And that wasn't what was happening at all.
That wasn't at all. And so one of the things I think that happened and emerged in Dr. King is that he had to move from pure, nonviolent, direct action, love ethic, to one that incorporated economic development, and that there is another way to think about resistance that doesn't have to be violent. The reason I say that is because Martin sounds a whole lot more like Malcolm as he moves toward the end, and Malcolm begins to sound a whole lot more like Martin as he moves to the end. And I think they both began to realize that the higher universal was about people. It instantiates itself in race, but it really is about people. Mm-hmm. Martin had support and lost support, remember. When he first started out, the Jewish community was very supportive in money and time and energy. But then when SNCC started to arise within the movement, and change it to from we shall overcome to say it loud, I'm Black and I'm proud, suddenly the Jewish community kind of pulled away. What do we do with that? And understandable. The Jewish community wasn't hip to James Brown at that time, but it became later.
Sure.
The influence of people like Harry Belafonte and Eartha Kitt, who would raise money. Literally what happened in Birmingham is that folk went out of the movement and counted every counter seat in every restaurant and every drugstore. And then they sent that number to sit in. When they were arrested, they had enough bail money to get them all out. And then they would send the next wave in. Harry Belafonte, Eartha Kitt, all those folk were in New York having concerts, raising money in order for that to take place. So there were lots of layers of the movement that took place. What was fascinating is how folk like that from so many different walks of life could commit to each other for something greater than themselves.
It is Black History Month, and talking about some of this, I always want to make sure that there's not the assumption that everybody agrees on all of these things. And I know that there are people that hear the conversation, about the civil rights era, that hear the conversation about slavery, that hear the conversation about a lot of different things and say, well, yeah, but that was the distant past and it's time to move on. How important is it to examine this stuff? How important is it to get truth out rather than just, okay, that was a long time ago, and no, we never did really get the full story? Because the situation I think of is the Greensboro massacre and the shooting of protesters there by the Klan and the what was found later to be involvement by the police department there, and a lot of different things going on there. And it took decades to get together what they've called a Truth and Reconciliation committee there, and they're still working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But how important is it for us to keep talking about this stuff rather than just say, hey, let's move forward and let's be forgiving about the past and try to fix the problems that exist now rather than talk about slavery?
Well, I don't think you can move forward until you understand what's behind you. Because where is forward?
Right.
And so an education about our history is an education about what we have to understand is Black history is also American history. And if as an American, we're going to get better, we have to be willing to look at both the good and the bad about who we are. There's a Native American story that needs to be told as well.
Yeah.
Oklahoma became a state out of the tragedy of Chalaki.
Yes.
Well, that story needs to be told. I remind American friends of mine, one is that I still stick with Du Bois. I still think I'm African and American, and quite happy and proud about that, actually. But that we have to remember that we owe a lot to Native American communities because they were places where Black people could go and live and have businesses. My grandmother ran a saloon and a restaurant in what's now Eden, Oklahoma. My mother was born in Oklahoma before it was a state and lived there as free Black people because it was Native American territory.
Right, yeah.
And the reason my mother came into the world is because my grandfather was a porter and he couldn't stay in town because it was segregated. Yeah. So he come out there, and next thing you know, Gladys is born. So, right? That there is a indebtedness we have to the Native American community, and unfortunately, one of the tragedies of the civil rights movement is that in our own movement forward, we forgot about people who helped us move forward sometimes, and okay. I think that's Native American folk in particular. But you have to look back. Well, we have to look back because some of the same games are being played. It's the same song. It's just different verse. Voter, for instance, House Bill 30 and HJR1, which is the House Joint Resolution that's before Missouri House of Representatives and Senate and will come to us. It's coming. And that's this whole thing about voter IDs.
Right.
It's a recapitulation of the old poll tax and tests that African-American folks in particular had to take before they could vote. When you watch Selma, one of the most moving parts is when the character played by Oprah has to take a test in order to vote. And why is that was moving to me? Because it reminded me of my mother and her father getting ready to vote. They had to practice. They would practice by saying the preamble to the Constitution or the Gettysburg Address. And then my dad would say, Gladys, now say it backwards, because they played all kinds of tricks.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how do you get an ID if you don't have an ID? And if the ID you take is not validated by the powers that be, then suddenly we have seniors, we have young people, and we have historic groups of people, Black and brown, who can't vote. I know people in New York who have never had a driver's license. I know people in St. Louis that don't have a driver's license.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they take public transit and they do other kinds of things. And so, you know, there's a case in Alabama of a guy who served two tours in Iraq. He brings his military ID and his driver's license. They wouldn't let him vote because he didn't have the proper ID. We're going back. If you don't look at your history, you'll be fooled by the game one more time.
Now, we talked earlier about different perspectives on all of this stuff, and you talking about that, and I think about getting my voter ID card on my 18th birthday at school. I think about going to the local caucus and talking about Mondale and all of the Gary Hart and all these cats back in 84 when I turned 18 to age myself a little bit there. I think about when I ran for school board some years back and taking my daughter and my son with me to watch me check off my own name. Very few other people did, but I did. And, you know, these are all very positive experiences. And it's really interesting to me to hear you talk about these stories and seeing that within your own family of having to study for a test that they were going to take. And why, over the course of a lifetime, people with those very different experiences might develop different attitudes toward voting, toward it being a right that has to be preserved as opposed to the social responsibility, and we have to make sure that it's being done correctly and avoid fraud, and et cetera, et cetera. It's just Right. You have to be aware of where other people are coming from.
Well, that was the reason of the test for the voting, right, is to make sure that authentic, legitimate Americans could vote. African Americans in this context.
Yeah.
But that's the same argument for the voter ID now, right? And so at the conversation before the elections committee in Jefferson City, one of the persons out of the House was asked how many cases of voter fraud was he aware of over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
He said one. In my own research, I looked up of elections over the last 12 years and how many cases of voter fraud had been committed or documented, and there were just over 2,000 across the country, which is one out of every 15 million voters. So one of the tricks that happens in a culture is that we'll take a sardine and turn it into a whale. That this whole thing about voter fraud, I think, is another reaction to the fact that an African-American president was elected twice, that these young people now who want a different world, that there's a whole movement happening in this culture about what it means to be free and American in this society.
C.W. Dawson is our guest, the Reverend Dawson, founder and president of Dawson Journeys Ministries, and is with the African American Clergy Coalition of Mid-Missouri. You talked a bit about your own family as somebody who is from Oklahoma and has a little Cherokee ancestry. I enjoyed that story a lot. I want you to talk about your own personal inspiration for some of the involvement politically and religiously. I've heard you tell the story about a march that your family took place in and your mom that I want you to share with us, because it's a difficult story, but it's also a very telling story about where you're from.
It is a difficult story. I am extremely grateful to the fact that my mother and father spent time with me. My father was part of, as a Baptist minister, one of the first group of preachers, African-American preachers, educated African-American preachers west of the Mississippi. My father was World War II Buffalo soldier. He was in the cavalry, in the 9th Cavalry, during the time of the segregated army. So my father was a very proud person, and I give thanks to him because he gave me a good role model, and so did my mother. My mom and dad were always involved in the movement from the beginning because they believed that there was something divine about what was happening in the movement for the civil rights of people. They did not take me to Birmingham or Montgomery or Selma, because they knew that that was going to be dangerous. It was in the South. But they decided to take me to Skokie. And the myth was is that since it's up north, it's not going to be violent.
Oh, my.
My mother and them had trained in the nonviolent direct action movement. So, you know, they were used to being called names and all that kind of stuff. But my mother also realized they were going to be on TV. So she went to have her hair done the day before, because she was not going to be caught as a black woman on TV without her hair looking right. So so my dad was marching. He's closer to the street. And then there is me and then my mother, because they wanted to make sure if trouble did happen, they would be able to surround me.
Sure.
And as we turned the corner, some anti-protesting folk had filled a bucket full of urine and feces. And as we turned, they dumped the bucket on my mother's head. And that was one of the few times I ever saw my father cry. And so my mother was 5 feet by 5 feet. And my mother stood and shook her head. I could just shook her head. And you could see pieces of feces and urine being shaken out of her head. And she started singing, I shall not be moved. I shall not. And by this time, the rest of the people around her start saying, I shall not be moved. That was, that's my mama, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those of us who have a mom can relate to how that must have been to see.
And yet for her to stand so heroically, right, in the midst of that, I'm not going to be moved. You can throw stuff at me. You can dump stuff on me. I'm still here. was a monumental event for me.
Reverend Clanton Dawson, C.W. Dawson, is our guest with Dawson Journeys Ministries and the African American Clergy Coalition of Mid-Missouri. We talked a little bit about the voting rights issues, but just in our final moments here, briefly talk about some of the other things happening in the Missouri legislature that you're keeping an eye on.
Well, again, those two issues right now are what we have most of our attention on, is the expansion of Medicare and on this whole movement about voter ID.
Mm-hmm.
What we think will happen with the voter ID is that it will go through the House and it will go through the Senate, but it's going to bypass. That's why they made it a joint House joint resolution.
Right.
So that way it bypassed the governor. The governor will have no opportunity to veto it. So it will come to the Missouri electorate, and we will have a chance in 2016 to vote on it, whether or not they want to make it part of the Constitution of Missouri, which is why I think it's most dangerous, because it wouldn't be just a passing thing. This could be seriously part of the Missouri amendment to the Missouri Constitution.
Which makes it a lot more difficult for Supreme Court of the United States or Supreme Court of Missouri to toss it out.
Absolutely. So we want to at a grassroots kind of movement to gear up and tell people let's not be fooled. The second thing, of course, is the Medicaid expansion. Over 700 people are estimated to die this year if it's not expanded. That's so important for everyone. But those are the ones that have my eye right now. I am watching what happens in the first ward election. I'm very concerned about the disparity between the district and other parts of the city.
Mm-hmm.
I went to one of the diversity breakfasts. I didn't go to the last one, but the one before, and the person who spoke said, when he came into Columbia, it just looked so idyllic. It looked wonderful because you could see the buildings of the university and housing, et cetera. And he said, I hope that you all will live like you look. My hope is that we learn how to live. Because, I mean, in Columbia, the issue is we have this narrative. Yeah. We all look happy, you know, we all have a little job, and, you know, we go to school, and it must be a wonderful place, no problems. But the fact of the matter is that there's a time bomb here ready to explode. And there are some issues that are so important that if they remain undressed, it could cause a very bad situation here in Columbia. What happened in Ferguson's already happened here.
Yeah.
The Lindsay woman was killed by the police here. So we really do have some issues that need to be addressed in this community.
we're closing our time with Reverend C.W. Dawson. I want to give you the opportunity because first of all, just for the people listening to have a little bit more of an idea of what it is that you're doing in addition to the African American Clergy Coalition, and also because I've had some personal involvement with it and think it's a cool deal.
Thanks.
Talk about Dawson Journeys and what it's really about.
Well, Dawson Journeys Ministry is an attempt to put together a non-traditional, interracial, intergenerational congregation. It is not a church in that we don't have membership. You know, you join the membership. Mm-hmm. But we do have a congregation. It's a group of people that continues to grow who come together. We worship at Rockbridge Christian Church. The pastor there, Maureen Dickman, as you know, is just a marvelous woman.
Yes.
And the board there allowed us to nest there in that church. So we meet on Fridays at 7 p.m., and we are attempting to put together a congregation that is socially active and yet helps people to grow in their own spiritual, moral lives. Most places in this town and around that call themselves integrated are under white leadership. There are very few, none I know of. And tokenism doesn't count.
Yeah.
One woman said, well, we're an integrated church. And I said, really? She said, yes, we have five. Out of a membership of 2,000,
yeah,
we have five.
That's
not it. Of an attempt to have an integrated congregation committed to social justice and openness and affirming of the human person to put together something fundamentally new in this town. So some people laugh. Some people pray for us. But it's moving. We're over a year old now, and we continue to get bigger and stronger.
Well, we want to thank you very much. You've been incredibly generous with your time, and it's been a really fascinating conversation, I think. Again, Reverend C.W. Dawson, founder and president of Dawson Journeys Ministries and the African American Clergy Coalition of Mid-Missouri. Both Dawson Journeys and the African American Clergy Coalition, by the way, are on Facebook, and we'll have the opportunity for you to find out more about both of those groups if you'd like to by going to our website. Go to kbia.org, click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. Reverend Dr. C.W. Dawson, wonderful to see you, my friend, and thank
Good
you so much
to see
for your time.
You too. Thank you.
And that is our show for this evening, Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Our thanks once again to C.W. Dawson for being so generous with his time. And I want to remind you also, if you missed part one of this show, you can find it at kbia.org. Just click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. Tonight's show was produced by Ross Terrell. The associate producer of Thinking Out Loud is Trevor Harris. Join us again next Tuesday evening for another Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Till then, I'm Darren Hellwedge. Have a great evening.